You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the 1970s, lead was not only in gasoline and paint, but also in water pipes and food cans, toothpaste tubes and toys, ceramics and cosmetics, jewelry and batteries. Lydia Denworth tells the story of Clara Patterson and Herbert Needleman, the two men behind the bitter 30-year battle to protect us from lead. They were forced to defend their research and reputations in the face of immense industry opposition. Toxic Truth, a Scientist, a Doctor, and a Battle Over Lead is published by Beacon Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Lydia Denworth, formerly of Newsweek and People magazine, mm-hmm. to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
When Needleman and Patterson started looking into the effects of lead in the 1950s, how big was the lead industry?
The lead industry was very big then. They were digging it out of the ground. They were using it in all kinds of things, and they had already put it in gasoline back in the 20s. And
now, they put it into gasoline because it eliminated the knocking sound?
It eliminated the knocking sound. It was Charles Kettering of Sloan Kettering and all lots of other things. His research lab, which was called Delco Research, Research Laboratory, part of GM, they wanted to solve this problem early on. It was the nascent automotive industry was really hampered by this knock, and he wanted to solve it and solve it with a product that would be cheap and that could be easily distributed. And that's where tetraethyl lead came from.
Is that why lead was put into these other things, that it just made the production of them easier?
In every case, it's really a different reason, but one of the things about lead and what industry has always said is lead is a useful metal, and it is. It's resistant to corrosion, it's malleable, it's strong, and there's a lot of it out there. It's naturally occurring in the earth, and so when we dig it up. In fact, they dug it up with silver originally, and for every ton of silver, you'd get 400 tons of lead. And so they, being ingenious people, we found a use for it.
And then solder used lead.
Solder used lead.
And so tin cans and all of the cans that we had, they put food into?
They put food into, and they thought that that was actually, ironically, they thought that they were stopping botulism by using the lead solder. But so that was a good thing, but what they were also doing was poisoning the contents of the food.
And water pipes.
Water pipes.
So we're talking about things that delivered stuff to us every day. We were living with a lot of lead.
Exactly.
Were people dying as a result? Did Sloan Memorial Sloan Kettering have to open just to combat what its founder had done to us?
I'm sure not. But what is true is that we will never really know how many people actually died from this because it was so often misdiagnosed, which is the other part of the story, is the medical side of it. They used to think that kids were dying from tubercular meningitis, but now researchers have gone back and looked at the records, and they're pretty sure that a lot of those children were dying from lead poisoning, and just nobody ever knew.
Did they not know, or was there the kind of cover-up we saw with the tobacco companies? Because there were scientists working for the lead industry. They must have had some kind of inkling, or else they weren't doing good work.
What they thought, well, you know, now it's very clear that they weren't doing good work. It's not entirely fair to say that we knew that then, though. One of the things that is really true about this is that medical truths change over time. It's more a question of how quick people were to be willing to embrace the possibility that there might be some other truth. And that science that really was controlled by the industry the first half of the 20th century. And a man named Robert Kehoe was medical director of Ethyl Corporation, which is the company that produced the lead additive for gasoline. He had four principles that he believed about lead. It was essentially that it was a normal, natural thing in the environment, that it, you know, below levels of 80 micrograms per deciliter, which is a technical term, but, you know, today we say 10 is a level of concern, the CDC says. Below 80, he didn't think anybody had any problem to worry about. Above 80 is where you get seizures and die and death.
Who's most vulnerable, children?
Children are most vulnerable because, as with so many things, it gets into the central nervous system, and when your central nervous system is developing, it's more vulnerable to damage. They're also more likely to put their hands in their mouth. They get lead on their hands. They put it in their mouth. You and I are less likely to do that.
Is lead poisoning the most common problem, or are there other health risks?
Lead poisoning is the most common problem, but actually, I would say that that's the umbrella term for a lot of the things that can go wrong in the body. What we think about with lead poisoning is it getting into children's brains and wreaking havoc, which it does. I say in the book, it's like the biochemical version of clipping wires and flipping switches, and things don't work as well. But it can get into the kidneys, and the liver, the heart, all kinds of things, actually. It can do harm.
So let's talk about the two people who really turned things around. Claire Patterson, what was his background before he started looking into the risks that were caused by lead?
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. He was a brilliant chemist. He was a farm boy from Iowa, basically, went to Grinnell College in Iowa, studied chemistry always, was just fascinated, even had a chemistry lab in his basement as a kid. And then he went to work on the Manhattan Project because, like many smart scientists at that time, he got pulled in, was looking for a way to help the war effort, worked on the Manhattan Project, and so got involved with mass spectrometers in their infancy, which comes into play later with his work on lead. And so then he goes to the University of Chicago in the late 1940s after the war to get his PhD in chemistry and was working on something totally different, which was the dating of the age of the Earth.
And he actually is the person who came up with the age of the Earth, 4.5 billion years?
He is the person who determined the age of the Earth.
And why isn't he more famous?
It's an excellent question. Now, part of it is because he was an eccentric guy, and a lot of people wasn't good at the soundbite, let's say, so he didn't do a lot of self-promotion. But also, for decades, nobody could replicate his techniques. They were so precise and so unusual for the time. And so it was a long time before his age of the Earth was actually recognized, and then before he got any recognition himself.
And it was because of that precision that he realized that lead was everywhere?
That's exactly right. As he's doing this one big thing, which should be enough for a career, you would think, he got diverted because the way he measured the age of the Earth is by measuring lead isotopes in these very, very small micrograms, which is a millionth of a gram. No one had ever measured in that minute a quantity before. But he said, okay, I'll give it a try. But to do that, obviously, you have to be exceedingly precise. And what he kept finding was that he had a rough idea of how much lead he should have. Uranium decays into lead. So he was measuring uranium, measuring lead isotopes. Taking all those measurements together, he should have been able to get an age. And he kept his lead numbers were always too high. And he said, this is not right. What is going on? And he realized that his lab was full of lead contamination from what he called every conceivable source, anything that came from industry, the water, the reagents, the equipment, literally the glass beakers he was using. And it was in the air. He was in the solder in the lab. And later he figured out that it was really embedded in the walls of the lab in a way that it was impossible to get an accurate measurement.
He also looked into how environmental changes had occurred by digging into polar ice.
He did. He was one of the very first to do that, which now we talk about with global warming. People are much more aware of that kind of work, but he was one of the first in the 60s. This was after he did finally succeed in dating the age of the Earth with his lead isotopes, which he did by inventing the ultra-clean lab. That's yet another accomplishment of his, which we also take for granted now. He finally got accurate measurements, and he was so fascinated by this problem of contamination that he really wanted to show how that contamination had occurred on a worldwide scale. So he went to Antarctica and Greenland in the 1960s, and he dug down, and he got samples all the way back to 800 BC of the ice. And then using these obsessive, you would say, clean techniques, he had to take that snow and ice back to Pasadena in these big 10-gallon barrels and then measure it. And what he found was that the level of lead in the environment had risen 750% between the Industrial Revolution and 1965 when he was there.
My guest is Lydia Denworth, who's written a book called Toxic Truth, The Scientist, The Doctor, and the Battle Over Lead, published by Beacon. So let's talk about the doctor. How does Mr. Needleman come into this story?
Well, what I thought was interesting about these two guys is that if Claire Patterson showed that the level of lead in the environment was unnatural, and that was the antithesis of what the industry people were saying. I mentioned Robert Kehoe earlier. He said, yes, there's lead, but it's normal. Patterson's showing, no, it's not. This is a contaminated level of lead. What Needleman does is then explain to us why that is such a bad thing and what it's doing to our bodies, and shows in particular what it's doing to children at levels below what cause clinical symptoms.
He was in Philadelphia and he was seeing lots of cases of lead poisoning in children?
He was a resident at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia in the 50s when it was in 18th and Bainbridge, which is South Philadelphia, and it was a fairly poor neighborhood, very typical inner city East Coast neighborhood, so he had a lot of kids living in houses with lead. But he was not that familiar with it. Very few physicians were at the time. He'd had one lecture at University of Pennsylvania Medical School on lead poisoning. But in fact, there was a doctor in the ER who had been in Brooklyn to do her training. And so she was far more familiar because they were a lot more aware about lead poisoning in Brooklyn at the time. And so he started to see cases. It didn't take him very many cases before he began to see that this was a more complicated problem.
How could he spot lead poisoning?
Well, in the case of his first one, this doctor in the ER actually is the one who recognized it. And the thing is, the problem, reason why it was misdiagnosed so often is because it looks like so many other things. It was often an extreme vomiting or lethargy. And so it was a question of, once you had a checklist of possible things, so stomach pain, vomiting, lethargy, coma, irritability, things like that, if you started to look for it, which he then did, he became chief resident and started to ask all of his people to test always. And then they discovered that so many of these children, that was what they had, but they probably would never have known.
And he could also tell by looking at children's teeth?
No, and not in the hospital. To look at their teeth, what he did later was, after this fascination with, you know, he said, you know, I think this is a much bigger problem than anyone has imagined. Number one, you have all these kids who are sick enough to be in the hospital from this. But two, if it's doing that much damage in the extremes, what's it doing along the way? It's very logical. And that's when he started to look at the teeth.
Now, you mentioned that this was most common in areas where there was a lot of poverty. Is that still the case today?
It is the case today that you are definitely the highest risk is still in poor neighborhoods, particularly among African Americans and in the city, living in dilapidated housing. But it's also true that there's plenty of middle-class kids who get affected because their parents renovate their houses. You know, they put a lot of dust up into the air.
And it's not just the paint. There was also industrial pollution that was causing a problem. And you write about lead poisoning among workers at the Standard Oil and DuPont plants.
Yes, well, that case was a particularly famous and horrible case back in the 20s when they were first manufacturing this tetraethyl lead, the additive for gasoline. And that is, it's an absolutely lethal product, the tetraethyl lead by itself. And what it does is it made these men insane, actually. They were carried away in straitjackets and 15 of them died. And that did briefly halt the sale of tetraethyl lead, but then the industry managed to argue that it was the fault of the workers, basically, for not taking appropriate care, and they got it back on the market.
Were there other countries that were dealing with this issue differently?
Absolutely. In the 1920s, well, I should point out that it was 1904 when two Australian doctors first linked lead paint to childhood lead poisoning. That's when we knew that those two things went together.
So this was all known. It was really the industry fighting all of this information?
It was the industry fighting the information. It was also, in the case of the medical side, it was true that there were a lot of doctors who just didn't pay attention. When those Australians did that, everyone in America seemed to think that that was a problem of the tropics, or it had nothing to do with them. So they really just didn't pay attention. And so in the 20s, you had about 12 other countries around the world actually banned lead paint for interior use then. We waited until 1978. Imagine if we could say today that only children living in houses built pre-1925 were at risk. That would be much better.
How did Patterson and Needleman first meet?
They first met at a lead conference. And Needleman at the time was just getting involved in this heavily in the 70s, and Patterson was already quite far down his path, and Needleman thought Patterson was nuts, really, frankly. and pretty soon he came to say, you know what, he's absolutely right. And that's one of the things about Patterson. Some people thought he was crazy, but several people said to me, the difference between being an eccentric and being visionary is being right, and he was right.
What was their first major campaign?
Well, what it was that
they decided to team up together?
They became friends and allies. It's not that they teamed up together in a concrete way where they actually did something different. But what they did do was continue to do their work together as allies and point to each other's work. Because one of the great lessons of lead is that we need to look at toxins with a multidisciplinary view, or just to come from it with a wide-angle lens. So Needleman's bringing the medical, the epidemiology. Patterson's bringing the chemistry and the environmental stuff. Then you got to go to the lab and look at the animal research. And when you do that and you look at all those pieces together, you really get a sense of the direction of the research. And that's where we made big progress, was when we could understand that. And so that's why I liked putting them together in this book. They were both critical people for the story, but also it's a metaphor, if you will, for how to approach the subject.
In Idaho, they found evidence that lead mines were causing problems for children.
Yes, sort of concentric circles going out from these smelters and lead mines in Idaho and in El Paso, Texas. In the 70s, that was one of the first places where they began to be able to put together the not just lead paint, but lead from smelting and from gasoline, lead in the air. And the kids were... the closer you got, the sicker they were.
So what happened when they started saying these things about lead? Did the lead industry come down on them hard?
They did. In Patterson's case, in the 60s, it was actually 1963 was when he wrote his first paper that suggested that the levels of lead that he was finding in the ocean at that point might be caused by leaded gasoline, that he looked at the numbers and said, then this is what would account for this. Well, his prime funding at the time was the American Petroleum Institute.
And he was at Caltech, which also probably
Caltech.
Depended on
right.
a lot of that kind
and,
of funding.
And this is another major lesson, and this is how critical funding for basic research is. The fact that he should have needed to get this money from American Petroleum Institute in the first place is he would have said that what he was doing had nothing to do with oil, but his you know wiser heads, if you I use the word wiser just in that that's what they thought at the time, that we got to get the money to do the work. Let's make the argument that somehow this will help to find oil. It wasn't necessarily doing that. But they canceled his funding almost immediately. Then they started calling the head of Caltech and seeing if they might not get him fired. He had a very hard time getting funding after that, and he was attacked loudly and vociferously through the rest of his career. And Needleman also... was in the end was called up on charges of professional misconduct at the behest of a psychologist who worked with the industry, and he was found not guilty repeatedly, but his he was put really through the ringer.
On the other hand, they won the fight, didn't they? The Clean Air Act of 1970 played a role. Was that as a direct result of what they'd been saying?
Yes, in fact, Patterson was one of the key witnesses at Ed Muskie's hearing, Senator Muskie's hearings that led to that 1970 Clean Air Act, he was very forceful. I mean, here was this scientist who, as I said before, he wasn't necessarily great at expressing himself, but in fact, he was quite powerful in front of Muskie, and that did help lead to the Clean Air Act. And then Needleman's work was what EPA was able to use in its cost benefit analysis that ultimately helped to get lead taken out of gasoline.
Now, they took the lead, they put the lead in to get rid of the NOx, but I don't hear NOx anymore in in automobiles, so
that's
the lead wasn't really necessary?
Well, it was necessary. It was one way of solving the problem. There were others, and they have since seized on the others. The sad thing is that, in fact, we did know some of the other solutions at the time. Ethanol existed, other things, but they chose to pursue this and not that. And really the entire history of lead, it reads like a series of missed opportunities.
Are we vigilant enough? Because there was a scandal last summer of toys that had lead paint on them.
Yes, that was an odd experience for me, because here I was steeped in the middle of all of this, and it was just like this echo that comes down. The first federal pamphlet about lead in toys was written in the 1930s, and then in the 50s, Mattel, there was a study that found that 25% of Mattel's toys had dangerously high levels of lead in 1957. So we've definitely been down this road before. We are being much more vigilant now. We have this new regulations that the Consumer Product Safety Commission has just put into effect. And not surprisingly, there's been some blowback about that. People say economically it's prohibitive. But I just feel that I've heard all these things before.
Lydia Denworth is a former Newsweek reporter and People Bureau chief. She's written about science, education, and other social issues in many publications, the New York Times, Red Book, Health, etc. And she has a book called Toxic Truth, The Scientist, The Doctor, and the Battle Over Lead, published by Beacon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Up next, Al and Larry Ubell, our gurus of how to, will have be here with tips on how to deal with unpredictable weather, and we will be taking your calls and questions on home repair, and of course we'll be talking about lead, because Larry is a real expert on lead poisoning. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.